3.2 blank 3.3 Amy didn't like him anymore, at least not in the way Ferguson wanted her to like him. And after the splendid days of last spring and summer, when the kissing cousins had left behind their cousinhood for a stab at true love, they were back to being just plain cousins. Amy was the one who had called off the romance, and there was nothing Ferguson could do to change her mind. For once a Schneiderman mind was made up, it was unbudgeable. Her chief complaints about Ferguson were that he was too self-involved, too pushy with his embraces, the persistent assaults on her breasts, which he wasn't ready to bear to him at age 14. Too passive in all other matters not related to her breasts, too immature, too lacking in a social conscience for them to have anything meaningful to talk about. It wasn't that she didn't feel a great and enduring fondness for him, she said, or that she didn't enjoy having the movie-crazed, basketball-playing, lazy-boned Ferguson as a member of her newly expanded family, but as a boyfriend, he was hopeless. The fling ended a couple of weeks before the end of the summer, 1961, and when school started again after Labor Day, Ferguson felt bereft. Not only would there be no more kissing rampages with Amy, but their pre-fling camaraderie had been smashed as well. No more visits to each other's apartments to do homework together, no more Twilight Zone episodes on TV, no more games of gin rummy, no more listening to records, no more outings to the movies, no more walks in Riverside Park. He still saw her at family gatherings, which tended to occur two or three times a month, the dinners and Sunday brunches at the two Schneiderman apartments, the excursions to the Sichuan Palace on Broadway and the Stage Deli on 7th Avenue. But he found it painful to look at her now, painful to be near her after being cast aside, rejected because he didn't measure up to her standards of what constituted a worthy, dependable human being. And instead of sitting next to her at those meals, as he always had in the past, he now positioned himself at the other end of the table and tried to act as if she wasn't there. In the last week of September, midway through a dinner at Uncle Dan and Aunt Liz's place, with the old goat blathering on about the poisonous radium the East Germans had planted in the Berlin Wall, Ferguson stood up in disgust, mumbled an excuse about having to visit the bathroom, and left the table. He did go into the bathroom, but only to hide from the others, since it was all getting to be too much for him. The obligation to maintain a mask of politeness in front of Amy at these family events, the still fresh wound reopening each time he saw her again, not knowing what to do or say in her presence anymore. And so he ran the water in the sink and flushed the toilet a couple of times to make the others believe he had gone in there to empty his bowels rather than to indulge in the miserable pleasure of feeling sorry for himself. When he opened the door, 3 or 4 minutes later, Amy was standing in the hall with her hands on her hips, a defiant, combative posture that seemed to demonstrate that she, too, had had enough. "What the hell is going on?" she asked. "You don't look at me anymore. You don't talk to me anymore. All you do is sulk, and it's getting on my nerves." Ferguson looked down at his feet and said, "My heart is broken." "Come off it, Archie. You're disappointed, that's all. And I'm disappointed, too. But at least we can try to be friends. We've always been friends, haven't we?" Ferguson still couldn't bring himself to look her in the eyes. "There's no going back," he said. "What's done is done." "You're joking, right? I mean, tough titties and all that, but nothing is done. Nothing has even started yet. We're 14 years old, schmuck face. Old enough to have our hearts broken." "Toughen up, Archie. You're talking like a pathetic little child. And I hate that. I just hate that. We're going to be cousins for a long, long time. And I need you to be my friend, so please don't make me hate you." Ferguson tried to toughen up. Hard as it was to listen to Amy tear into him with those scolding remarks, he understood that he had allowed his soft-minded, self-pitying impulses to get the better of him. And unless he put a stop to it, he would turn into Gregor Samsa and, quote, "awake one morning from uneasy dreams to find himself transformed into a gigantic bug." He was in the 9th grade now, the first year of high school, and although his academic performance at the Riverside Academy had always been respectable, his marks had slipped a little in the 7th and 8th grades, perhaps from boredom, perhaps from an over-reliance on his natural abilities to carry him through with less than an all-out effort. But the work was more demanding now, and it wouldn't be possible to answer test questions about how to conjugate irregular French verbs in the passé simple, or put dates on things such as the defenestration of Prague and the diet of worms, if he didn't put in the study time to master those abstruse particulars. Ferguson resolved to lift his grades to the highest level he could imagine for himself, nothing less than A's in English, French, and history, and nothing less than B-pluses in biology and math, a stringent but realistic plan of action, since striving for A's in the last two subjects would have taken so much extra work that basketball would have been pushed out of the picture. And when tryouts began after the Thanksgiving break, he was determined to make the freshman team. He did make it, as a starting forward, and his coursework met expectations as well, although not precisely in the way he had predicted, for the A in French wound up as a disappointing B+, and the B+ in biology evolved into a miraculous A-. But no matter. Ferguson made the honor roll for the first semester, and if Amy had been a student at the Riverside Academy, she would have known how well he had done. But she wasn't, and therefore she didn't. And because her angry, heartsick cousin was too proud to tell her that he had toughened up, she never knew how deeply she had shamed him into trying to prove her wrong about who he was. All that said, it went without saying that he still wanted her, that he would have done anything to win Amy back. But even if he eventually managed to make her want him again, it was going to take time, perhaps a long time. And in the interval between not having her anymore and perhaps having her again, he figured the best strategy for turning things around would be to find himself a new girlfriend. Not only would that show he had lost interest in her and had put their breakup behind him, which was essential, it would distract him from thinking about her all the time. And the less he thought about her, the less he would mope, and the less he moped, the more attractive he would appear to her. A new girlfriend would make him a happier person, and emboldened by his newfound happiness, he would surely be nicer to Amy at family gatherings, more charming, more in control of his feelings, and whenever the occasion presented itself, he would talk to her about current events. That was one of her principal gripes against him, his indifference to politics, his lack of concern about what was happening in the big world of national and international affairs. And to remedy that deficit, Ferguson resolved to follow the news more closely from now on. 2 papers were delivered to the apartment every morning, the Times and the Herald Tribune, although Gil and his mother read the Times and largely ignored the Herald Tribune, even if it was Gil's employer, for the joke in the family was that the Herald Tribune was too pro-Republican to be taken seriously by anyone who lived on the Upper West Side. Nevertheless, Gill's reviews and articles appeared roughly every other day in that Park Avenue organ of Wall Street money and American power, and Ferguson's morning job was to cut out the pieces with Gill's byline on them and stow the clippings in a box for his mother, who was planning to put together a scrapbook of Gill's writings one day. And Gil was forever telling him not to bother with that rubbish. But Ferguson, who understood that Gil was both embarrassed by the attention and secretly pleased by it, would shrug and say, "Sorry, orders from the boss being yet another name for the already double-named Rose Adler, Rose Schneiderman. And Gil would nod with feigned resignation and reply, "Natürlich, mein Hauptmann, you mustn't get in trouble for not following orders." So the Times and the Herald Tribune were there for him to read in the morning. And when the afternoon rolled around and he came home from school, a copy of the New York Post had generally found its way into the apartment as well. And on top of the dailies, there were Newsweek, Life, and Look, in which his mother sometimes published photographs, I.F. Stone's Weekly, The New Republic, The Nation, and assorted other magazines. And Ferguson diligently plowed through them now instead of turning straight to the film and book reviews in the back, reading the political articles in order to figure out what was going on out there and thus figure out how to hold his own in a conversation with Amy. Such were the sacrifices he was willing to make in the cause of love, for even as he turned himself into a more informed citizen, a more vigilant observer of the battles between Democrats and Republicans, of America's interactions with friendly and unfriendly foreign governments, he still found politics to be the dullest, deadliest, dreariest subject he could think of. The Cold War, the Taft-Hartley Act, underground nuclear testing, Kennedy and Khrushchev, Dean Rusk and Robert McNamara, none of it meant much to him. In his opinion, all politicians were either stupid or tainted or both. And even handsome John Kennedy, the much-admired new president, was just another stupid or tainted politician to Ferguson, who found it much more nourishing to admire men like Bill Russell and Pablo Casals than to waste his feelings on pompous windbags scrambling for votes. The only three things from out there that truly engaged his attention in the last months of 1961 and the first months of 1962 were the Eichmann trial in Jerusalem, the crisis in Berlin, because Gil and Uncle Dan were so wrapped up in it, and the civil rights movement at home, because the people were so brave, and the injustices they had exposed him to were so obscene that they made America look like one of the most backward countries on earth. The quest for a substitute Amy was not without its problems, however. It wasn't that Ferguson was expecting to discover anyone who resembled her, since Amy was not the sort of girl who had been designed for mass production, but he was reluctant to settle for anything less than a top-quality alternative. Nothing to compare to Amy, perhaps, but a scintillating person who would bowl him over and quicken the pace of his heart. Unfortunately, the most promising candidates had already given their hearts to others, among them the ever more beautiful Isabel Kraft, the Hedy Lamarr of the freshman class, who was dating a boy from the sophomore class, as was her attractive cousin, Alice Abrams, as was Ferguson's former flame, the honey-voiced Rachel Mineta. That was one of the central facts of ninth-grade life. Most of the girls were more advanced than most of the boys, which meant that the most impressive girls shunned the boys from their year for the more advanced boys from the next year, if not the next year plus one. Hoping for a quick result, success by mid-October at the latest, that is, 3 weeks after Amy had told him to toughen up, Ferguson was still searching well into November. Not from any lack of effort on his part, 4 movie dates with 4 different girls on 4 successive Saturdays, but simply because none of the girls he went out with was the right one. By the time school recessed for the Thanksgiving break, he was beginning to wonder if any girl at the Riverside Academy would ever be the right one. Basketball helped to distract him from the disappointments of love, at least for 5 days of the week, with loveless weekends to be endured by seeking further distraction from such things as pickup games with his friends, occasional Saturday night parties, movies with whatever person he could find to go with him, often his mother, and concerts with Gil or Gil and his mother both. But there was no question that playing basketball for the 11 weeks the season lasted helped to keep him from falling into too many mope holes, beginning with the 1 week tryout period and the grand satisfaction of making the last cut, followed by an exhausting week of after school practices as the team knit together under the direction of Coach Nim, often referred to as Coach Num because of his placid disposition. And then 9 weeks of games, 18 games in all, one on Tuesday afternoon and the other on Friday evening, half the games on their home court and the other half on the courts of other private schools scattered around the city, the newsreel cartoon freshman game before the curtain rose on the main feature varsity game, and there was Ferguson, the oddball who had asked to wear number 13, running onto the court with the other members of the starting five and taking his position for the center jump. All those Saturday mornings in Riverside Park with Cousin Jim had helped transform the raw, 12-year-old beginner into a solid, if unspectacular, player by the time he scored 7 points in his first game for the Riverside Rebels at the age of 14 years and 9 months. Ferguson knew that his talents were limited, that he lacked the exceptional speed required for basketball greatness. And because he was less nimble with his left hand than his right, he would never be more than an iffy ball handler when pressured by quick and aggressive opponents. No flash, no razzle-dazzle, no fake-them-out-of-their-pants one-on-one moves. But there were enough strong points about Ferguson's game to keep him off the bench and make him an indispensable part of the team. Most of all, the spring in his legs, which allowed him to jump higher than anyone else. And when you combined that ability with the reckless enthusiasm of his play, an insane form of hustle that earned him the nickname of Commando-in-Chief, the result was an unusual knack for muscling deft, clean rebounds when he crashed the boards against taller players. He rarely missed layups, and his outside shot was good, with the potential to become very good, but the accuracy he showed at practice was seldom matched by his performance in games, since he tended to rush his shots in the heat of competition, which made him an erratic offensive player that first year, someone capable of scoring 10 or 12 points when a shot was on, or 2 points or no points when it was off. Thus the 7 points he scored in the first game, which turned out to be his average for the season. But with the games only 32 minutes long, and the point total somewhere in the 35 to 45 range for each team, 7 a game wasn't bad. Not terribly exciting, perhaps, but not bad. Ra, ra, siskum ba, rebels, rebels, ya, ya, ya. The numbers meant little to him, however. And as long as the team won, he didn't care how many points he scored. But even more important than winning or losing was the mere fact that he was on the team in the first place. He loved wearing the red and yellow Rebels uniform with the number 13 on it. He loved the 9 other boys he played with. He loved Coach Nim's pepless but insightful pep talks in the locker room at halftime. He loved riding on the bus to the away games with his teammates and the 10 varsity boys and the 6 varsity cheerleaders and the 4 freshman cheerleaders. He loved the chaos of merriment and loud jokes on the bus, and especially when junior class cut-up Yigi Goldberg got suspended for 2 games for pulling down his pants and sticking his bare ass against the window to moon the people in the passing cars. He loved playing so hard that he was no longer aware of being inside his own body, no longer conscious of who he was. He loved working himself into a sweat at practice and then feeling the hot water from the shower blast the sweat from his skin. He loved that the team had started off slowly and gotten better as the season went along, losing most of the games in the first half and then winning most of them in the second half to wind up with an almost even 8-10 record. And he loved it that one of the wins came against Hilliard at home, when he scored just 3 points but led the team in rebounds. Ho, ho, tic-tac-toe, rebels, rebels, go, go, go. The best part of it was that people came to watch, that there was always a crowd in the small gym at Riverside for the 2 games, not thousands or even hundreds, but enough to make it feel like a spectacle, with Chucky Showalter pounding on the bass drum to urge the team on. And nearly everyone in Ferguson's family showed up at one time or another to root for the Commander-in-Chief. Uncle Dan, most of all, who didn't miss a single home game, and his mother next, who failed to come only when she was out of town for her work, and several times an appearance from Mr. No Sport Gill, and once cousin Jim, down from Boston on his midwinter break from college, and once, for the game against Hilliard, Miss Amy Schneiderman herself, who saw Ferguson take a hard tumble, trying to save a ball from going out of bounds, who saw him thrust his shoulder into a Hilliard player and knock him to the floor as they battled for an errant pass, who saw him block a layup from going into the basket in the 4th quarter to keep Riverside ahead by 3 points, and after the game was over, she said to him, "Good show, Archie. A little scary at times, but fun to watch." "Scary?" he asked. "What does that mean?" "I don't know. Intense, maybe. Super intense. I hadn't realized basketball was supposed to be a contact sport." "Not always, but under the boards you have to be tough." "Is that what you are now, Archie? Tough?" "Don't you remember?" "What are you talking about?" "Toughen up. You don't remember?" Amy smiled and shook her head. Ferguson found her so unbearably beautiful at that moment, he wanted to throw his arms around her and attack her mouth with kisses. But before he could do anything that foolish and disgraceful, Uncle Dan walked up to him and said, Terrific job, Archie. The jump shot might have been a little off, but I think it was your best all-around game so far. Then the basketball season was over, and it was back to the no-girlfriend void of no Amy and no one else. The only girl he saw with any regularity was last year's Miss April, and the copy of Playboy Jim had passed on to him before heading off to college. But Wanda Powers of Spokane, Washington, a grinning 22-year-old with gravity-defying cantaloupe breasts and a body that seemed to have been manufactured from a rubber model of the real Wanda Powers, had begun to lose her hold over Ferguson's imagination. Antsy and demoralized, ever more frustrated by the stuckness of his position in the world, dragged down by his dulled hopes and the feverish daydreams that had supplanted those hopes, the useless and incessant mental journeys into realms of voluptuous happiness, where everything he wished for came true, Ferguson decided to make a last attempt to patch things up with Amy and start their romance again. But when he called her 5 days after the end of the season, asking her to accompany him to the team party that would be held at Alex Nordstrom's place on Saturday night, she said she was busy. Well, he asked, what about the day after that? No, she said, she was busy on Sunday as well. And then he learned that she would continue to be busy for as long as it lasted. It being the mutual love she had formed with a person she refused to name. And that was that, Ferguson said to himself. Amy had a boyfriend, Amy was gone, and the green fields of hope had turned to mud. A number of unpleasant incidents occurred in the wake of that dispiriting phone call. One, getting drunk for the first time in his life on the evening of the party, when he and fellow team member Brian Mashevsky broke into the Nordstrom's liquor cabinet and stole an unopened bottle of Cutty Sark, which they hid in the inside pocket of Ferguson's winter coat and then carried back to Brian's apartment when the fete at the Nordstrom's was over. Fortunately, Brian's parents were out of town for the weekend, which explained why they picked his apartment as their watering hole. And fortunately, Brian remembered to tell Ferguson to call his own parents and ask permission to spend the night before they cracked open the bottle and downed two-thirds of its contents. Two-thirds of that two-thirds scalding its way down Ferguson's throat and landing in his stomach where, unfortunately, it didn't remain for long. For Ferguson had drunk just one can of beer and two glasses of wine before that night and had no experience with the intoxicating powers of 86-proof distilled scotch, and not long before he passed out on the living room sofa, he puked up the entire swizzle on the Mashevsky's oriental rug. 2. Just 10 days after that binge of weepy, semi-suicidal drunkenness, he tangled with Bill Nathanson, formerly known as Billy, the large toad who had been tormenting him since his first year at the Riverside Academy, at long last letting loose with a barrage of punches to Nathanson's fat belly and pimple-studded face when the cretin called him a stupid prick in the lunchroom. And even though Ferguson was punished with 3 days of after-school detention, along with a sharp warning from Gil and his mother to shape up, he had no regrets about having lost his temper. And as far as he was concerned, the satisfaction of pummeling Nathanson was well worth the price he had to pay for it. 3. On a Tuesday afternoon in late March, less than a month after his 15th birthday, he skipped out of school immediately following lunch, walked from West End Avenue to Broadway, and went to the movies. It was going to be a one-time-only exception, he told himself, but the rules had to be broken that day because the film he wanted to see would not be showing the next day or on any other day in the foreseeable future. And Cousin Jim, who had seen Children of Paradise at the Brattle Theatre in Cambridge, had told Ferguson that he must see it the next time it came to New York, or else lose the right to call himself a human being. The picture was scheduled to start at 1, and Ferguson covered the 10 blocks to West 95th Street and the Thalia Theatre as quickly as he could, telling himself that if he had been a little bit older, he wouldn't have had to resort to truancy, since there was another showing of the film at 8 o'clock. But Gil and his mother never would have given him permission to go on a school night, especially not to a movie that was over 3 hours long. There would be the matter of inventing an excuse for them, he supposed, but nothing had come to mind so far, and the best and simplest one, that he had felt sick after lunch and had gone home to lie down, was not going to work in this case, because Gil and his mother were almost certainly in the apartment. Gil in his study, working on his book about Beethoven, and his mother in her darkroom developing pictures. And even if his mother happened to be out, there was a 99% chance that Gil would be in. Not having an excuse was a problem, but as with most of the problems Ferguson created for himself, he tended to jump first and worry about the consequences later, for he was a young man who wanted what he wanted precisely when he wanted it, and woe to the person who stood in his way. On the other hand, Ferguson reasoned, as he half walked and half trotted up the crowded sidewalk in the frigid March air, he wasn't missing much of anything by cutting his Tuesday afternoon classes, which consisted of gym and study hall, and since Mr. McNulty and Mrs. Wohlers rarely bothered to take attendance, he might even get away with it. And if he didn't, and if he still hadn't managed to come up with a false explanation by the time he saw Gil and his mother again, he would simply tell the truth. He wasn't committing a crime or an immoral act after all. He was going to the movies, and few things in this world were better than going to the movies. The Thalia was a small, oddly shaped theater of roughly 200 seats, with thick, sight-obstructing columns and a sloping floor that stuck to the bottoms of your shoes because of all the sodas that had been spilled on it over the years. Cramped and dingy, almost laughable in the range of its discomforts, with the ancient springs and the seat cushions digging into your ass, and the smell of burnt popcorn wafting into your nose, it was also the best place on the Upper West Side for watching old films, which the Thalia presented at the rate of 2 per day. Every day a different double feature, 2 French films today, 2 Russian films tomorrow, 2 Japanese films the day after that, which explained why Children of Paradise was on the Thalia program that afternoon and not showing anywhere else in the city, perhaps anywhere else in the country. Ferguson had been there a couple of dozen times by then, with Gil and his mother, with Amy, with Jim and Amy together, with friends from school. But as he showed his student ID and paid the 40 cents for his discount ticket, he realized that he had never been there alone. And then, as he found a seat in the middle of the 5th row, he further realized that he had never been to any movie alone, not just at the Thalia, but anywhere. Not once in his life had he sat in a movie theater alone, for movies had always been about companionship as much as the movies themselves. And while he had often watched his Laurel and Hardy movies alone when he was a small boy, that was because he had been alone in the room where he was watching them. But now there were other people in the theater with him, at least 25 or 30 other people, and he was still alone. He couldn't tell if that was a good feeling or a bad feeling, or simply a new feeling. Then the film started, and it no longer mattered if he was alone or not. Jim had been right about this one, Ferguson said to himself, and all through the 3 hours and 10 minutes that Children of Paradise played before him on the screen, he kept thinking about how much it had been worth it to risk punishment in order to see this film, which was just the sort of film that would appeal to a 15-year-old of Ferguson's temperament, a florid, high romantic love saga, punctuated by bursts of humor, violence, and cunning depravity, an ensemble piece in which every one of the characters is essential to the story, the beautiful, enigmatic Garance, Arletty, and the 4 men who love her, the mime, played by Jean-Louis Barrault, a soulful, passive dreamer, destined to limp through a life of longing and regret, the exuberant, bombastic, supremely entertaining actor, played by Pierre Brasseur, the cold-hearted, ultra-dignified count, played by Louis Saloux, and the devious monster played by Marcel Aron in the role of Lacenaire, the poet murderer who stabs the count to death. And when the film ended with Garance disappearing into a vast Parisian crowd as the heartbroken mime chases after her, Jim's words came rushing back to Ferguson. The best French film ever made, Archie. The Gone with the Wind of France. Only 10 times better. and although Ferguson had seen only a handful of French films at that point in his life, he agreed that Les Enfants du Paradis was much better than Gone with the Wind, so much better that it was useless even to compare them. The lights came on, and as Ferguson stood up and stretched his arms, he noticed someone three seats to his left, a tall boy with dark hair, who must have been a couple of years older than he was, in all probability another hooky-playing cinephile. And when he glanced over at his fellow renegade, the boy smiled at him. "Some film," the stranger said. "Some film," Ferguson repeated. "I loved it." The boy introduced himself as Andy Cohen, and as he and Ferguson walked out of the theater together, Andy said that this was the third time he had seen Children of Paradise. And did Ferguson know that the criminal Lasnier, the mime Duberreau, and the actor Lemaître had all been real people from France in the 1820s? No, Ferguson confessed, he hadn't known that. Nor had he known that the film had been shot in Paris during the German occupation, nor that Arletty had gotten herself into a heap of trouble at the end of the war for having an affair with a German officer, nor that the writer Jacques Prévert and the director Marcel Carnet had collaborated on several films in the 30s and 40s and were the inventors of what critics called poetic realism. This Andy Cohen was certainly a well-informed young man, Ferguson said to himself, and while he might have been showing off a little, trying to impress the backward young neophyte with his superior knowledge of film history, he was doing it in a friendly way somehow, more from an excess of enthusiasm than from any kind of arrogance or condescension. They were out on the street by then, walking south down Broadway, and within four blocks Ferguson had learned that Andy Cohen was 18, not 17, that he hadn't cut any classes to go to the movie because he was a freshman at City College and had no classes that afternoon. His father was dead, a heart attack, 6 years ago, and Andy and his mother lived in an apartment on Amsterdam Avenue and 107th Street. And because he didn't have any plans for the rest of the day, maybe he and Ferguson could go to a coffee shop somewhere and have a bite to eat. No, Ferguson said. He had to be home by 4:30 or else. But maybe they could get together some other time. Saturday afternoon, for instance, when he knew he would be free. And the moment Ferguson said the word Saturday, Andy reached into his coat pocket and pulled out the Thalia program for March. "The battleship Potemkin," he said. "It's playing at 1 o'clock. "The Thalia at 1 on Saturday," Ferguson replied. "I'll see you there." He extended his right arm, shook Andy Cohen's hand, and the two parted company, the one continuing south toward Riverside Drive between 88th and 89th Streets, and the other turning around and heading north toward what might or might not have been home. As expected, Gil and his mother were in the apartment when Ferguson walked in. But, as not expected, the school had already called to report his unauthorized departure. Gil and his mother had those worried looks on their faces that always saddened Ferguson and made him realize how unpleasant it must have been for them to be the grown-ups responsible for taking care of someone like him. For the call from the school meant that his whereabouts had been unknown from 12:30 to 4:30, which was more than enough time for conscientious parents to start fretting about their missing teenager. That was why his mother had established the 4:30 rule. Be home by then or else call home and explain where he was. The limit had been extended to 6 o'clock for the basketball season because of after-school practices, but the basketball season was over now and the 4:30 deadline was back in effect. Ferguson had walked into the apartment at 4:27, which on any other day would have kept him in the clear. But he hadn't counted on the school to call so promptly. And for that stupid oversight he was sorry, not just because of the scare he had put into Gil and his mother, but because it made him feel like an idiot. Half of his allowance was docked for the following week, and for the 3 school days that remained from the current week, he was held after dismissal to work in the lunchroom, mopping floors, scrubbing pots, and scouring the large 8-burner stove. The Riverside Academy was an enlightened, forward-looking institution, but it still believed in the punitive virtues of KP duty. On Saturday, a day of relaxed curfews and relative freedom, Ferguson announced at breakfast that he was going to the movies with a friend that afternoon. And since Gil and his mother were generally good about not asking too many unimportant questions, no matter how much they might have wished to know the answers, Ferguson didn't name the movie or the friend, and he left the apartment in time to reach Thalia by 10 to 1. He wasn't expecting Andy Cohen to be there, not when it seemed so unlikely that he would have remembered their hastily plotted rendezvous at the theater door. But now that Ferguson had discovered the pleasures of watching films alone, the prospect of being alone again didn't bother him. Nevertheless, Andy Cohen had remembered. And as the two of them shook hands and bought their 40-cent tickets, the college boy was already launching into a brief lecture on Eisenstein and the principles of montage, the technique that had supposedly revolutionized the art of filmmaking. Ferguson was told to pay special attention to the scene on the Odessa steps, which is one of the most famous sequences in movie history. And Ferguson said he would, although the word Odessa had a somewhat troubling effect on him, given that his grandmother had been born in Odessa and had died in New York just 7 months earlier, and Ferguson regretted that he had paid so little attention to her when she was alive, no doubt assuming she was immortal, and that there would be plenty of time to get to know her better in the future, which of course never happened. And thinking about his grandmother made him think about his grandfather, whom he still missed terribly, and by the time Ferguson and Andy Cohen took their seats in the fifth row, which they agreed was the best row in the house, the expression on Ferguson's face had changed so radically that Andy asked him if anything was wrong. "I'm thinking about my grandparents," he said, "and my father, and all the dead people I've known," pointing to his left temple. "It gets pretty dark in there sometimes." "I know," Andy said. "I can't stop thinking about my father, and he's been dead for 6 years." It helped that Andy's father was dead too, Ferguson thought, that they were both the sons of non-existent men and spent their days in the company of ghosts, at least on the bad days, the worst days, because the glare of the world was always brightest on the bad days. Perhaps that explained why they sought out the darkness of movie theaters, why they felt happiest when sitting in the dark. Andy said something about the hundreds of cuts that had gone into editing the big scene. But before he could tell Ferguson exactly how many there were, a number he surely knew by heart, the lights dimmed, the projector went on, and Ferguson turned his attention to the screen, curious to discover what all the fuss was about. The townspeople of Odessa waving to the striking sailors from the top of the steps. A wealthy woman opens her white umbrella. A legless boy doffs his cap, and then the word suddenly, and the face of a terrified woman fills the screen. A crowd of people charging down the stairs, the legless boy among them, as the white umbrella rushes into the foreground. Fast music, hectic music, music racing faster than the fastest pounding heart. The legless boy in the center as the crowd streams down on either side of him. A reverse shot of the soldiers in their white uniforms chasing the people down the steps. A close-up of a woman getting up from the ground. A man's knees buckle. Another man falls. Still another man falls. A wide shot of the running crowd as the soldiers run down the stairs in pursuit. Close shots of people hiding in the shadows. The soldiers take aim with their rifles. More cowering people. Lateral shots of the crowd. Frontal shots of the crowd. And then the camera begins to move, sprinting along beside the crowd of sprinting people. Rifles blasting from above, a mother running with her little boy until the boy in the white shirt falls down face first. The mother keeps running, the crowd keeps running, the boy in the white shirt is crying, blood is dripping from his head, the white shirt is speckled with blood. The crowd keeps running, but now the mother realizes that her son is no longer with her and stops. The mother turns around, looking for the boy. A close-up of her anguished face. The crying boy in the bloodied shirt passes out. The mother opens her mouth in horror and grabs hold of her hair. A tight shot of the unconscious boy as legs and more legs rush past him. The music continues to pound. A close-up of the mother's horrified face. The endless crowd continues to pour down the steps. A boot comes down on the boy's outstretched hand. A closer shot of the crowd pouring down the steps. Another boot comes down on the boy. The bleeding boy rolls over onto his back. An extreme close-up of the mother's horrified eyes. She begins to move forward, mouth open, hands in hair. The crowd pours down. The mother approaches her fallen son. She bends down to pick him up. A wide shot of the frenzied, charging crowd. A reverse shot of the mother, carrying the boy back up the stairs in the direction of the soldiers. Her mouth is moving. Angry words are coming out of her. A broad shot of the dense crowd. A closer shot of some people crouching behind a stone wall. Among them, the woman with the pince-nez. So it began, and as Ferguson watched the sequence unfold, he found the slaughter so gruesome that his eyes eventually filled up with tears. It was unbearable to watch the mother being gunned down by the Tsar's soldiers. Unbearable to watch the killing of the second mother and the awful journey of the baby carriage down the steps. Unbearable to watch the woman with the pince-nez howling with her mouth wide open and one lens of her pince-nez shattered and blood gushing from her right eye. Unbearable to watch the Cossacks pull out their swords to slice the baby in the carriage to bits. Unforgettable images, and therefore images to go on producing nightmares for 50 years. And yet, even as Ferguson recoiled from what he was watching, he was thrilled by it, astonished that anything as vast and complex as that sequence could possibly have been put on film. The pure magnitude of the energy unleashed by those minutes of footage nearly split him in two. And by the time the film was over, he was so shattered, so exhilarated, so mixed up in a confusion of sorrow and elation, that he wondered if any film would ever affect him in that way again. There was a second Eisenstein feature on the program, October, known in English as 10 Days That Shook the World. But when Andy asked Ferguson if he wanted to see it, Ferguson shook his head, saying he was too exhausted and needed to get some air. So they went out into the air, not quite certain what to do next. Andy suggested they go back to his apartment so he could lend Ferguson his copy of Eisenstein's Film Form and the Film Sense, and maybe scrounge up some food as well. And Ferguson, who had no plans for the rest of the day, thought, why not? During the walk to West 107th Street and Amsterdam Avenue, the mysterious Andy Cohen divulged some more facts about his life. First of all, the fact that his mother was a registered nurse at St. Luke's Hospital and was working the 12 to 8 shift that day and wouldn't, thank God, be at home when they got there. And the fact that he had been accepted by Columbia, but had decided to go to City College because the tuition was free there and his mother couldn't afford to send him to Columbia. And yet, what a nice kick in the pants to know he had the stuff to make the Ivy League. And the fact that, much as he loved movies, he loved books even more. And if everything went according to plan, he would get a PhD and wind up as a professor of literature somewhere, maybe even, at Columbia. As Andy talked and Ferguson listened, Ferguson was struck by the enormous gap that separated them intellectually, as if the 3-year difference in their ages represented a journey of several thousand miles that Ferguson had yet to begin. And because he felt so ignorant when he compared himself to the big-brained college student walking beside him, Ferguson asked himself why Andy Cohen seemed to be working so hard at trying to become his friend. Was he one of those lonely people who had no one to talk to, Ferguson wondered, a person so hungry for companionship that he would settle for anything that dropped in front of him, even when it came in the form of a know-nothing high school boy? If so, it didn't make much sense. Some people had flaws, character flaws, or physical flaws, or mental flaws that tended to isolate them from others. But Andy didn't seem to be one of them. He was amiable and relatively good-looking. He was not without a sense of humor, and he was generous, e.g. the offer to lend Ferguson the book. In short, someone who fell into the same category of person as Cousin Jim, who was just 1 year older than Andy and had many friends, more friends than he could count on the fingers of 12 hands. In fact, now that Ferguson thought about it, the effect of being with Andy was not dissimilar to what it felt like to be with Jim. The comfortable sense of not being looked down upon by someone older than he was, of older and younger, walking down the street together at the same pace. But Jim was his cousin, and it was normal to be treated like that by someone in your family, whereas Andy Cohen, at least for now, was little more than a stranger to him. The future professor lived in a small, two-bedroom apartment on the third floor of a run-down 11-story building, one of the many Upper West Side residential towers that had sunk into decrepitude since the end of the war. Once a modest dwelling place for members of the middle class, and now occupied by an assortment of struggling people who spoke several languages behind the locked doors of their apartments. As Andy showed Ferguson around the sparsely furnished, well-ordered rooms, he explained that he and his mother had been living there since his father's third and final heart attack. And Ferguson understood that this was just the kind of place he and his mother might have rented if there had been no life insurance money to carry them through the rough years after his own father's death. Now that his mother had married again and was earning decent money as a photographer, just as Gil was earning decent money from writing about music, they were so much better off than Andy and his poor nurse mother that Ferguson felt ashamed of his good fortune, which he had done nothing to contribute to, just as Andy had done nothing to contribute to his less than good fortune. Not that the Cohens were poor, exactly. The refrigerator was well stocked with food. Andy's bedroom was crammed with paperback books. But when Ferguson sat down in the small kitchen to eat one of the salami sandwiches Andy had prepared for them, he noticed that this was a household that collected green stamps and cut out discount coupons from the Journal American and the Daily News. Gil and his mother counted dollars and tried not to overspend, but Andy's mother counted pennies and spent whatever she had. After the snack in the kitchen, they went into the living room and talked for a while about Madame Bovary, which Ferguson hadn't read, The Seven Samurai, which Ferguson hadn't seen, and the other films on the Thalia program for next month. Then something strange happened, or something interesting, or something strangely interesting, which in any case was unexpected, or at least it seemed so at first. But then, as Ferguson began to think about it a little, not as unexpected as all that. For once Andy asked the question, Ferguson finally understood why he was there. He was sitting on the sofa across from Andy, who was sitting in an armchair by the window. And after a short lull in the conversation, Andy leaned forward in his chair, looked at Ferguson for a long moment, and then asked, apropos of nothing, "Do you ever jerk off, Archie?" Ferguson, who had been a dedicated onanist for close to a year and a half, answered the question promptly. "Of course," he said. "Doesn't everyone?" "Maybe not everyone," Andy replied, "but almost everyone. It's perfectly natural, n'est-ce pas? If you're too young for real sex, what else can you do?" "And what do you think about, Archie? I mean, what goes through your head while you're jerking off?" "I think about naked women and how nice it would be to be naked with a naked woman instead of jerking off into the toilet." "Sad." "Yes, a little sad, but it's better than nothing." "And has anyone ever jerked you off? One of your high school girlfriends, maybe?" "No, I can't say I've had the pleasure." "I have, a few times." "Well, you're older than I am. It makes sense that you've had more experiences." "Not many experiences, just three, in fact, but I can tell you it's a lot better when someone else does it to you than when you do it yourself." "I can believe that, especially if the girl knows what she's doing." "It doesn't have to be a girl, Archie." "What's that supposed to mean? Are you saying you don't like girls?" "I like girls very much, but they don't seem to like me. I don't know why, but I've never had any luck with them." "So you've been jerked off by boys?" "Just one boy, George, my friend from Stuyvesant, who never had any luck with girls either. So last year we decided to experiment, just to see what it felt like. And it was great. We jerked each other off those three times, and we both decided that it doesn't matter who does it to you. A girl or a boy, the feeling is the same, and who cares if it's a girl's hand or a boy's hand wrapped around your dick?" "I never thought about it that way." "No, I hadn't either. It's what I would call a major discovery." "Why just three times, then? If you and George liked it so much, why did you stop?" because George is at the University of Chicago now, and he's finally found himself a girlfriend. Too bad for you. I suppose, but George isn't the only person in the world. There's you, Archie, and if you'd like me to do it to you, I'd be happy to jerk you off, just so you'll know what I've been talking about. But what if I don't want to jerk you off? Maybe George liked doing that, but I don't think I'd be interested. Nothing against you, Andy, but I really do like girls. I would never ask you to do something you don't want to do. That would be wrong, and I don't believe in pressuring people. It's just that you're such a nice boy, Archie. I like being with you. I like looking at you, and I would love to be able to touch you. Ferguson told him to go ahead. He was curious, he explained, and Andy could jerk him off if he wanted to, but just this once, he added, and only if they turned out the lights and pulled down the shades, for a thing like this had to be done in the dark. So Andy stood up from his chair and one by one turned out the lights and pulled down the shades, and once he had completed those tasks, he sat down on the sofa next to the anxious, slightly panicked Ferguson, unzipped the younger boy's pants, and dug in. It felt so good that Ferguson started to moan. Within seconds, his soft and nervous penis began to stiffen and grow progressively longer with each stroke of the older boy's hand, which was a skilled and deeply knowledgeable hand, Ferguson thought, a hand that seemed to know precisely what a dick needed and wanted on its journey from slumber to arousal and beyond. The exquisite back and forth between rough and gentle manipulations, so good, he said, when Andy asked him how it felt. And then Ferguson unbuckled his belt and slipped his pants and jockey shorts down to his knees, giving the wondrous hand more room to operate, and suddenly the other hand was on him as well, playing with his balls as the first hand worked on what was now a full-scale erection, Ferguson's 15-year-old cock at the very limit of where it could go. And once again, Andy asked him how it felt, but this time Ferguson could only grunt forth a wordless response as the pleasure spread through his thighs and up into his groin, and the journey to beyond was done. "Now you know," Andy said. Yes, now Ferguson knew. Just 2.5 minutes, Andy said. The best 2.5 minutes of his life, Ferguson thought, and then he glanced down at his shirt, which was visible now that his eyes had adjusted to the dark, and saw that it was splattered with the stains of his ejaculation. Damn it, he said, look at my shirt. Andy smiled, patted Ferguson on the head, and then leaned over and whispered into his ear, D.H. Lawrence comes in torrents when his Balzac with desire. Ferguson, who had never heard that old college ditty, let out a long squeal of surprised laughter. Then Andy recited the dirty limerick about the young man from Kent, another classic that was not yet familiar to Ferguson, and the young innocent, who was rapidly losing his innocence, burst out laughing again. When calm was restored, Ferguson pulled up his pants and rose from the couch. Well, he said, I guess I should rinse out this shirt. And as he started walking from the living room to the kitchen, undoing the buttons as Andy stood up and followed him, he explained that the shirt was new, a birthday present from his mother and stepfather, and he had to get the spots out or else find himself in the unpleasant position of being asked questions he would prefer not to answer. Strike fast, he said. Remove the stains before they settled into the fabric and destroy the evidence. As the two of them stood at the sink together, Andy asked Ferguson if he was a one-and-done sort of guy or someone with the staying power to go an extra round or two. Ferguson, who had forgotten all about just this once, asked him what he had in mind. Something good, Andy said, unwilling to reveal the secret, but he assured Ferguson that it would surpass the pleasures of the living room sofa and make him feel even better than he did now. The stains were concentrated on the bottom part of the shirt, from the midpoint of the shirt tails to an area between the second and third buttons. And Andy washed them out for Ferguson, quite quickly, as it happened, with little scrubbing required, and when the job was done, Andy carried the wet shirt into his bedroom and put it on a hanger, which he looped over the knob on the closet door. There you go, he said, good as new. Ferguson was touched by the sweetness of that small gesture, which showed how thoughtful and considerate Andy was, and Ferguson enjoyed being doted on in that way, cared for by someone kind enough to wash out his shirt and put it on a hanger for him. Not to mention the kindness to jerk him off without asking to be jerked off in return. Whatever qualms or hesitations Ferguson might have felt in the beginning were gone now. And when Andy suggested he take off his clothes and lie down on the bed, Ferguson happily took off his clothes and lay down on the bed, anticipating the next good thing that was about to be done to him. He understood that most people would have frowned on what he was doing, that he had entered the dangerous territory of forbidden, deviant impulses, faggot land in all its corrupting, lascivious glory, and that if anyone found out he had traveled to that wicked country, he would be mocked and hated and possibly even beaten up for it. But no one was ever going to find out because no one would ever be told, and even if it had to remain a secret, it would never remain a dirty secret, for what he was doing with Andy didn't feel dirty to him, and what he felt was all that mattered. His cock grew hard again as Andy ran his palms over Ferguson's naked skin, and when Andy put that hardened cock into his mouth and gave Ferguson the first blowjob of his life, Ferguson was long past caring whether it was a girl or a boy who was giving it to him. He wasn't quite sure what to think. Undeniably, the two orgasms that had swept through him and out of him in Andy's apartment that day were the strongest, most gratifying physical pleasures he had ever experienced. But at the same time, the means to the end had been purely mechanical, a one-sided operation in which Andy did to him what he had no desire to do to Andy. What they had done then was not quite sex in the strictest sense of the word, at least not sex as Ferguson understood it, since for him sex had always been about two rather than one, the physical expression of an extreme emotional state, the longing for another person. And in this instance, there had been no longing, no emotion, no anything but the desires of his dick, meaning that what had happened with Andy wasn't sex so much as a higher, more enjoyable form of masturbation. Was he attracted to boys? Until then, he had never even asked himself the question. But now that he had allowed Andy to jerk him off and suck him off and run his hands over his naked body, he began paying more attention to the boys in his school, especially the boys he knew best and liked best, which included everyone on the freshman basketball team, all of whom he had seen naked in the shower and locker room scores of times without giving the matter a second thought. But now that he was starting to think about it, he tried to imagine what it would feel like to kiss elegant Alex Nordstrom on the lips, a true kiss with tongues digging into each other's mouths, or to jerk off muscular Brian Mashevsky until he came all over his bare stomach. But neither one of those pretend scenes produced much of a reaction from Ferguson. Not that he was repulsed by them or scared by the thought of engaging in real boy-on-boy sex, for if it turned out that he was a faggot boy, without having known it until now, then he wanted to know for sure, beyond any doubt or possibility for error. But the fact was that the idea of embracing other boys didn't excite him, didn't make his dick grow hard, didn't fill him with the lustful thoughts that sprang from the wells of deepest yearning. But Amy excited him, and even now the thought of his never again to be touched or kissed lost first love continued to fill him with deepest yearning. And Isabel Kraft excited him, especially after he saw her walking around in her red bikini last June 28th on the 10-person group outing to Far Rockaway. And when he thought about the naked bodies of his friends and compared them to the almost naked body of Isabel Kraft, he understood that girls aroused him and boys didn't. But maybe he was deluding himself, he thought. Maybe he was wrong to think that emotions were an essential part of sex. Maybe he should consider the various forms of loveless sex that brought physical release but no emotions of any kind. Masturbation, for example, or men screwing whores, and what that must have been like in relation to what being with Andy had been like. Sex without kisses or feelings. Sex for the sole purpose of attaining physical pleasure, and maybe love had nothing to do with it. Maybe love was just a high-flown word to cover up the dark, uncontrollable demands of animal lust. And if you were in the dark, I couldn't see the person who was touching you. What difference did it make how you managed to get your juices flowing? An unanswerable question. Unanswerable because Ferguson was still just 15 years old, and whether time would transform him into a man who sought the company of women, or a man who sought the company of men, or a man who sought the company of both women and men, it was far too early for him to know who he was or what he wanted when it came to matters of sex. For at that point in his life, which was also that point in history, that particular moment in that particular place, America in the first half of 1962, he was barred from having sex with members of what he believed to be the right sex. For even if he managed to win back the affections of Amy Schneiderman, or make a surprise conquest of Isabel Kraft, neither one of those girls would allow herself to do to him what Andy Cohn had already done. And now that his body had evolved into the body of a man, he still found himself trapped in his boy's world of enforced virginity, even as he reached the moment when he had begun to crave sex with a passion that would not be equaled at any other moment in his life. And because the only sex available to him at that moment of thwarted desire was sex with a member of the wrong sex, he showed up at the Thalia Theater the next Saturday afternoon to see Rashomon with Andy Cohen. Not because he had formed any special attachment to the City College boy who lived with his mother on Amsterdam Avenue and West 107th Street, but because the things that boy did to him felt so good, so excessively and extraordinarily good, that the feeling was all but irresistible. They got down to it more quickly the second time, dispensing with the preliminaries on the living room sofa and heading straight for Andy's bedroom, where they both wound up with their clothes off. And while Ferguson couldn't bring himself to touch Andy where he wanted to be touched, to jerk him off in the same way Andy was jerking him off, he watched as Andy did it to himself and didn't mind when the cum landed on his chest, which felt rather nice, actually, the warmth of it, the suddenness of it, and then the languor of Andy's slowly moving hand as he rubbed the ejaculation into Ferguson's skin. It was becoming more about two now, less about one, and more about leaving behind the good of glorified wanking for the better of something more like real sex. And for three Saturdays in a row, following that second time together, the Saturdays of The Blue Angel, Modern Times, and La Notte, Ferguson gradually eased his way into abandoning himself to Andy's bolder and bolder seductions. No longer holding back, as he submitted to the promptings of Andy's tongue as it moved up and down the length of his body, no longer frightened to be kissed or to kiss in return, no longer hesitant to take hold of Andy's stiffened cock and put it in his mouth, for reciprocity was fundamental, Ferguson realized. Two was infinitely more satisfying than one, and only by seducing the seducer could he thank him for the pleasure of being seduced. Andy was softer and flabbier than Ferguson, skinny and tall, but with the no-muscle body of someone who never played sports or did any exercise. And he was fascinated by the hardness of Ferguson's muscles, the basketball body Ferguson had built for himself by lifting weights and doing 100 push-ups and 100 sit-ups every night. And again, Andy would tell Ferguson how beautiful he was, running his hand over Ferguson's taut stomach and marveling at its flatness, telling him that his face was beautiful, that his ass was beautiful, that his cock was beautiful, that his legs were beautiful. So many beautifuls that by the second of the last three Saturdays they spent together, Ferguson was beginning to feel oppressed by them, as if Andy were talking about him in the way that he, Ferguson, would talk about a girl, which was another subject Ferguson was beginning to have some doubts about. The question of girls, since every time he mentioned Isabel Kraft's remarkable looks or said something about how much he still loved Amy Schneiderman, Andy would make a face and then come out with some insulting crack about girls in general, saying that their brains were genetically inferior to the brains of men, for example, or that their cunts were cesspools of infection and disease. Ugly, ridiculous statements that seemed to suggest that Andy had not been telling the truth in March when he said he liked girls, for not even his mother was exempt from his bitter condemnations, and when Ferguson heard him call her a sad, dumb cow, and another time call her a revolting tub of shit, he countered by saying he loved his own mother more than anyone else in the world, to which Andy replied, "Not possible, kid, just not possible." Later on, Ferguson understood how badly he had misread the situation from the start. He had assumed that Andy was just another sexed-up boy like himself, unlucky with girls, and therefore willing to have a go at it with a boy. Two boys rolling around with each other for the fun of it. Fuck fun for adolescent virgins. But it had never once crossed his mind that anything serious could come of it. Then, on the last Saturday they spent together, just minutes before Ferguson had to leave the apartment, as the two of them lay side by side on the bed, still naked, still sweaty and out of breath, each one drained by the exertions of the past quarter hour, Andy took Ferguson into his arms and said that he loved him, that Ferguson was the love of his life, and he would never stop loving him, not even after he was dead. Ferguson said nothing. Any word would have been the wrong word at that moment, so he held his tongue and said nothing. Sad, he thought. So sad and demoralizing to have created such a mess. But he didn't want to hurt Andy's feelings by telling him about his own feelings, which were that he didn't love him back, and would never love him back for as long as he lived. And this was goodbye, and too bad it had to end this way because the fun had been so much fun. But damn it all, he shouldn't have said that, and how could he be so stupid? He kissed Andy on the cheek and smiled. "Gotta go," he said. Ferguson sprang off the mattress and began collecting his clothes from the floor. Andy said, "Same time next week?" "What's playing?" Ferguson asked as he climbed into his jeans and buckled his belt. "Two Bergmans, Wild Strawberries and the Seventh Seal." "Whoops! Whoops! What's whoops?" "I just remembered I have to go up to Rhinebeck with my parents next Saturday." "But you still haven't seen any Bergmans. That's more important than a day with moms and pops, no?" "Probably, but I have to go with them." "The week after next, then." Ferguson, who was slipping into his shoes at that point, mumbled a barely audible, "Uh-huh." "You're not going to come, are you?" Andy sat up in bed and repeated the words at the top of his voice. "You're not going to come, are you?" "What are you talking about?" "You bitch," Andy yelled. "I pour my heart out to you, and you don't say a fucking word." "What do you want me to say?" Ferguson zipped up his spring jacket and headed for the door. "Fuck off, Archie. I hope you fall down the stairs and die." Ferguson left the apartment and walked down the stairs. He didn't die. Instead, he walked home, went into his room, and lay down on the bed, where he spent the next 2 hours looking up at the ceiling.